You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the summer 2019 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Do you realize who you're dating? I could be the President of the United States. We could celebrate my 50th birthday in the White House. You can't be a waitress. Inside the Epic Fall of Michael Avenatti by Emily Jane Fox. Opening photograph by Philip Montgomery. Michael Avenatti in New York City. Michael Avenatti was looking at his phone, scrolling through his Twitter mentions when it all came crashing down. Not long before noon on March 25th, he was walking toward an escalator in the newly opened 720,000-square-foot shopping mall in the middle of Hudson Yards. It's a city within a city, purpose-built, for people who don't much like Manhattan, even if they want to live here, with restaurants run by Michelin-starred chefs, shiny new high-rise apartment buildings, and headquarters for companies like Warner Media and Related, and, as it happened, the law offices of Boies Schiller Flexner, the white shoe firm that represents Nike. Less than a week earlier, Avenatti had contacted the athletic apparel giant and offered it a hard bargain. One of his clients, a youth basketball coach, was alleging that Nike had paid high school basketball players. The allegations on their own would be explosive, but weaponized by Avenatti in a media war in the midst of earnings season and March madness, they could pose an existential threat to Nike, as he'd made clear to the company's attorneys, according to prosecutors. "The company will die," he told the lawyers. "Not die," he clarified, "but they are going to incur cut after cut after cut after cut, and that's what's going to happen as soon as this thing becomes public." But Avenatti had offered them some options. If the company agreed to pay his client $1.5 million and hire him to conduct an internal investigation, he would keep the whole thing quiet. Or for $22.5 million, full confidentiality, we ride off into the sunset, he offered. Otherwise, what's going to happen is that this is going to snowball, he told them, and every time we got more information, that's going to be in the Washington Post, the New York Times, E-SPAN, a press conference. Even though he was taking the meeting, Avenatti had a sense of how things might go with Nike's lawyers, so he readied for battle, much as he had over the last year. He tipped off a couple of reporters that he had news and fired off a tweet alerting the 837,000 followers he'd amassed in the past year, telling them that at 11 a.m. the following day, he would be holding a press conference to disclose a major high school college basketball scandal perpetrated by at Nike that we have uncovered. This criminal conduct reaches the highest levels of Nike and involves some of the biggest names in college basketball. He watched the retweets and mentions and likes roll in on his phone as he headed up the escalator toward Blue Bottle Coffee for some caffeine. That's when four FBI agents surrounded him. "Michael Avenatti?" one asked. "Yes," he responded. "FBI," they told him. "You're under arrest." The agents pulled him aside to the entrance of a store. They took his briefcase and his cell phone before pulling a large trench coat around his shoulders so they could handcuff him discreetly. "I told them I appreciated the fact that I wasn't treated like Roger Stone," Avenatti told me, "and that CNN was not outside waiting for me." One of the officers laughed. "I said, of course, that's because hopefully I've shown your office and law enforcement a lot more respect over the last 14 months." The agents managed to hustle him out of the mall without being noticed, a remarkable feat in the smartphone era and the year of Avenatti, and let him wait in a hidden alcove while the car that would take him to be booked pulled around. Booked at the police station across from the courthouse on Pearl Street, Avenatti was allowed one phone call, which he used to call his mother. She knew what had happened to her son before he called, because Jeffrey Berman, the U.S. attorney in Manhattan, had already held a press conference detailing what he called an old-fashioned shakedown of Nike. Avenatti told me in May that at no point did he attempt to extort Nike, and any claim to the contrary is absolutely baseless. Once Nike and Boy Schiller realized that they could not control me, they came up with this stunt of going to SDNY, U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York, and telling prosecutors and the FBI 10% of the story, he said. Almost simultaneously, federal prosecutors in Los Angeles filed a 197-page complaint accusing him of wire and bank fraud, in which the office detailed allegations of Avenatti misappropriating client settlement money for personal use. The receipts were gaudy. $216,720 to a Neiman Marcus, six figures to a Porsche dealership, and $68,500 at a luxury watch store. The complaint also claimed that Avenatti defrauded a bank by submitting false tax returns in order to obtain millions of dollars in loans. A few weeks later, on April 11th, federal officials in California handed down a 36-count indictment, including 19 tax-related charges, 10 counts of wire fraud, 4 counts of bankruptcy fraud, and 2 bank fraud charges. Avenatti had taken money from one scheme and used it to lull clients, to string them along, to prevent them from going to authorities, and took money from different pots as needed. One such client was a paraplegic man who had reached a $4 million agreement to settle a case related to his injuries, but had not received the money. Avenatti allegedly deposited some of the settlement into a personal account associated with his car racing team. Avenatti pleaded not guilty. He would not get into specifics about the case, but told me, "I look forward to all of the documents and all of the facts coming to light when it comes to the allegations set forth." He noted, "The facts, in reality, are not as clear-cut as the government has made them out to be." The day after the government handed down the indictment, Avenatti sat across a table from me in an appropriately all-glass building on Santa Monica Boulevard. He was dressed in his usual custom suit, even on a warm, sunny Friday afternoon, with no plans to set foot in a cable news station or courtroom or in front of a podium for a press conference. Typically, he was his own media strategist. My attorneys thought this was a terrible idea and that I should not do it under any circumstances, he told me. Next photos, in good hands. On The View, March 2018, and with Stormy Daniels at the Abbey, May 2018. During the interview, Avenatti cried on 4 separate occasions, including when he talked about the call he made to his mother after he was arrested. "You never want to call your mother and tell her that you're in custody," he said, his voice dipping into a near whisper as it broke. "And you especially don't want to call and tell her you're in custody when she's already seen it all over the news because they've had an effing press conference." He paused. "But live by the sword, die by the sword." There is no question that Avenatti has been living his life by the sword for the past year, and for a while, for many Democrats, he was an unlikely hero, a hashtag resistance warrior, the moment required. Robert Mueller, fastidiously doing his work in private, respecting norms, keeping his mouth shut, decently, diligently playing his part, was a man from a different era, however much faith Democrats put in him. And as they waited for Mueller to do his work, many at least entertained the theory that defeating Trump could mean becoming more like him, fighting him on his own terms, and feeding an insatiable desire for publicity. Avenatti was Trump's perfect foil, a pugnacious, take-no-prisoners combatant who fought Trump where Trump lived. Like the president, he understood that politics and making money were media games, and where Michelle Obama counseled to go high, Avenatti, by analysis and instinct, went low. He mirrored the president in his easily wounded, rageful narcissism. And as we have learned about Trump, as much as Avenatti dreamed of great, ceaseless notoriety, living his life completely in public, he had much he needed to keep hidden, too. In his book, Full Disclosure, published last fall, Stormy Daniels described her first meeting with Avenatti in February 2018. She wrote that she was supposed to meet another lawyer, but he canceled at the last minute and sent a colleague in his stead, leaving her to feel dumped onto some guy who was probably a junior attorney. That attorney, of course, was Avenatti. Avenatti himself has always been uncharacteristically reticent about how he met Daniels, citing, not terribly believably, attorney-client privilege. All he would say was that he was introduced to Daniels through a lawyer he had worked with in the past, who he said thought she'd be better served by someone who had a skill set that would lend itself to that. At the time, Avenatti was not, by any means, a junior attorney. Plaintiffs' lawyers make their money by fomenting outrage at corporate villains, or threatening to, and then capitalizing on it all. Avenatti is highly skilled at that game. He said that he has won two judgments, totaling over $1 billion. In reality, the number is much smaller, since many of them have been reduced on appeal. In 2014, he won an $80 million class action settlement from a Los Angeles cemetery accused of dumping remains in a mass grave. In 2008, a $32 million judgment against KPMG for audit malpractice. And in the spring of 2017, he helped win a $454 million judgment against Kimberly-Clark for defective surgical gowns that hospitals used to protect doctors from blood-borne diseases, a suit he filed during the height of the Ebola crisis. The case earned him his biggest media coup yet, an appearance on 60 Minutes, where he was interviewed at length by Anderson Cooper. The case was a potent, addictive mix of moral fervor, raw aggression, fame, and wealth, and it put him on the runway for his takeoff the following winter. But in other ways, Avenatti was on the brink. The wins, while lucrative, couldn't keep up with his ever-burgeoning expenses, which, according to a divorce filing from his second wife, Lisa Story Avenatti, had swelled to include a $19 million Newport Beach mansion, several race cars, and monthly family cost, including a staff of nannies, an assistant, and a driver, she estimated at $200,000, along with shares in two private jets. Next photos, White House mess. Avenatti outside federal court in New York City in March. Speaking at the Occupy Lafayette Park demonstration in Washington, D.C., July 2018. Around the time he met Daniels, Avenatti's life was essentially unraveling. His second wife had filed for divorce in January. Avenatti disputes the claims in her filing, I hardly think that I am the first person to have a batshit crazy ex-spouse who overstates things to fit their financial demands, he told me in response. A month before that, Avenatti's law firm made a $10 million settlement for back pay with a former partner who claimed that the firm failed to provide him with copies of its tax returns and had misstated its profits. By March, the coffee chain Tully's, which he bought through his company Global Baristas with the actor Patrick Dempsey, had closed all its stores. By that time, the IRS had been after him and the company for years, claiming that Global Baristas owed $5 million in federal taxes. And then there was the issue of a $1.6 million settlement for a client in a civil case, which was due to his client on March 10th. The settlement had come through to Avenatti, but instead of transferring it to his client, the complaint alleges, he put the money into his own account. When his client repeatedly asked Avenatti when the money would come in, he allegedly lied about the fact that it already had, in fact, been paid to him. He has pleaded not guilty to the charge. As much as anything, the Stormy Daniels case was a way of shifting his personal narrative, leaving behind the morass of his marriage and his finances. Avenatti quickly realized that the case could be greater than the sum of its parts, ethically, politically, financially. And for a plaintiff's lawyer, it had that indispensable attribute, a great villain. When I met with Stormy, I saw an avenue by which I could do collateral damage to Donald Trump and those around him for what appeared to me to be illegal conduct and rigging a presidential election. I saw that as an opportunity to do something that was just, that was right, and to basically go all in. It was his skill set and his strategy, Avenatti explained, that took her case from what could have been a two-day story and turned it into a case cable news host chewed over night after night, week after week, month after month. She was known as headlining the Make America Horny Again tour, and I took her to another level, he said. Daniels denied repeated request to be interviewed for this story. On March 6, 2018, he filed a lawsuit against the President of the United States on behalf of Daniels in a California civil court, seeking to void the 2016 non-disclosure agreement prohibiting Daniels from discussing her supposed affair with Trump. The following morning, he appeared solo on Today, kicking off a flurry of interviews that would keep him in green rooms and on cable news sets and shuttling from one studio to the next in black cars for weeks. From a virtual unknown, Avenatti became one of the most famous people in America, a cable news pugilist who was actually going toe-to-toe with the president and drawing blood. For a while, it spun faster than anyone, including Avenatti, could control. There were stories written about his body fat percentage and his suits. Odes were written about the color of his eyes, which sits symmetrically above his steep jaw like two infinity pools. Women he'd never met before started texting him racy photographs. And, of course, television bookers put him as a frequent hitter in their rotation. Perhaps Avenatti's most Trumpian quality was the tension between his desire to be talked about incessantly and his crepey, thin-skinnedness if and when that talk turned to criticism, whether in the media or from strangers on Twitter. He would routinely respond to people who emailed him comments after he appeared on cable news, calling small-town lawyers who'd written him notes to chew them out for their remarks, according to people familiar with this practice. He berated Time magazine after it published a story, quoting him saying that the next Democratic nominee would likely have to be a white man, demanding that the publication release the transcript of his interview. He once threatened the Daily Caller with a defamation suit, messaging the reporter that this is the last warning. His girlfriend, through much of his year in the spotlight, Morelli Minuti, recalled that he rarely put his phone down and would scroll through all of his Twitter mentions. He would say, "Oh my God, this asshole said this, and you know what I did? I effing blocked that MF." Behind the scenes, his behavior was even more volatile. He had a terrible temper, one primetime anchor told me. He never lost it with me, or really with any of the talent, as far as I know, because it was mostly for the bookers or the people who were behind the scenes. But he would tell people, "I'm going to effing bury you. Why the F would you do that?" If he didn't like something. A number of reporters recalled that he would physically invade their space. His nose gets millimeters from your face, and it's clear he knows no boundaries, one broadcast reporter and producer told me. Last spring, a print outlet published a story that called into question whether Avenatti had paid someone for information that would have helped his client. According to two people, he confronted the reporter on a cable set to express his displeasure and started to shout, "F me once, shame on you." People came up to her afterward to make sure she was okay. That's how aggressive and alarming it was. His temper often flared when producers and bookers tried to vet stories he was involved in. "It felt like we were enabling a total rageaholic," one booker told me. "It was pathological." Lisa Story Avenatti, Michael's estranged wife, with whom he is locked in a bitter public divorce, detailed his rages in her divorce filing. She called him hot-tempered and used to having his way, adding that when he doesn't, he gets extremely loud and verbally aggressive. The filing included one incident in December 2017 when she said he showed up at their Newport Beach home demanding to get in. Police were called to settle the situation. In early May, paparazzi snapped photos of Story Avenatti and Minuti having lunch in Hollywood. Minuti posted a photo of them together on Instagram, with a drawing of a little white heart between the two of them. Avenatti told me that he can have a short fuse at times, but he quickly offloaded some of the responsibility, considering how much hatred, vitriol, bullshit he's had to put up with. He thinks he's done a remarkably good job. "It's not an excuse," he said. "I've been under a tremendous amount of pressure, and I think I've done a very good job, but I haven't been perfect by any stretch. If the charge is that I am a fiery, passionate guy at times, I'll plead guilty to that." Like many people with rage issues, Avenatti can swing just as fast in the other direction. The anchor who said he'd heard Avenatti tell people he would effing bury them also remembered meeting him for the first time in the hallway outside the set, and Avenatti laying on praise. "He stopped me and looked at me and got so close to my face that I thought this guy was going to kiss me, but he just kept saying what a big fan he was." A reporter Avenatti raged at noted that it was part of a cycle of unpredictable behavior Avenatti tried to manipulate but could not quite control. The temper thing he couldn't rein in, but he would do this thing on the other end where he tries to make it seem like you're the only one he's talking to, like you're the special one, even though he's doing that to everyone else. It's a truly powerful thing. No one knew Avenatti's rage cycle better than Minuti, a model who moved to the United States from a little town in Estonia on a gap year after high school. She ran into Avenatti in October 2017 at Ciccone's in Hollywood. She was 23 at the time and out with a girlfriend when the lawyer, then 46, approached her and asked her to have dinner with him. After a few weeks, she was essentially moved into a luxury high-rise in Century City. They traveled in Europe for a few weeks in November, and he offered to pay her rent and about $1,000 in spending money each month. Avenatti said that his financial support far exceeded that amount. He didn't want her to work, she told me, sitting in her attorney Michael Bachner's Manhattan office in early April, within spitting distance of the charging bull sculpture down past Wall Street. She turned up in ripped black jeans and dainty silver rings on five of her fingers. She had a mess of blonde hair, pulled back by the black sunglasses she kept on her head for much of 2 hours, and Jessica Rabbit lips that quivered as she detailed what she called a year of verbal, psychological, and physical abuse. Avenatti has denied ever physically harming anyone. Any allegation that I have ever been physical with a woman is complete nonsense, he told me. By the spring, months into their dating, she told him that she was thinking about getting a waitressing job. I wanted to be more social and earn some money to pay my credit card. But he said, Marilee, really? Do you realize who you're dating? I could be the next president of the United States. We could celebrate my 50th birthday in the White House. You can't be a waitress. Another woman Avenatti was romantically involved with also told me that Avenatti had asked her if she wanted to be first lady. Avenatti denied telling Meniotti that she could not wait tables. He said that he'd perhaps joked with a few women about being first lady, but many more had approached him asking if they could have the role. Meniotti rarely knew which Michael she would wake up to, she said. He has two extremely different personalities, she explained. One was this very powerful guy. I saw people who would shake his hand. They respected him. I was so proud of him when he first started representing Stormy. The other, she said, was very aggressive. By the summer, when his schedule was busy enough that they would only have a few days together at a time, his temper flared. On their way to dinner one evening, when she opened up to him about an eating disorder she struggled with and started to cry, he turned the car around and told her that she was effing the whole night up by bringing it up on their one night out together, that she was an effing idiot to start crying and making drama on their way out for a nice night. It was my fault at the end of everything, she told me. That was just something I got used to. He would yell at me for bringing something up by asking if that's really how I wanted to spend what little time we had together. I wanted to be a supportive partner, so I let it slide off. But I felt really scared when I could see one side of him, then the other, within a half-hour period, up and down, up and down. It was not until February, 4 months into their dating, that she said he became physically abusive. It was his birthday, and he had wanted to spend the night before going out with a friend who was in town. She went out separately with her friends, and when Avenatti returned to his apartment and saw that she was not yet home, he texted her asking where she was. She said she told him that she would be home in an hour. When she got there, she said she could tell that he was drunk. She had been drinking, too, and he laid into her. He was upset that I could be so disrespectful and selfish on his birthday. If he texted me that he's home, he told me that I should come right away and that that's how relationships work. She had gotten into bed before he jumped up and started yelling at her to get the F out of the apartment. I don't want you here tonight, he told her. When she got up to leave, she said, he literally threw her out the door into the hallway where she hit her head on the wall. I made excuses after that, she said. The excuse that time was that we were both drunk and emotional, and I really did not believe that he would do something like that again. He did, though, she said. By early November, she had maxed out her credit card. She'd bought him a $500 limited edition Yves Saint Laurent cologne. It smelled so sexy, she said, for their anniversary, though, she says, he had not gotten her anything. She had asked him for money, because her accounts were overdrawn and she didn't have enough cash to order food or put gas in her car. He had put $2,000 in her account on November 13th, just before she went to work on set for a Snoop Dogg music video. It hadn't yet cleared, so she had to ask one of the other girls to pay for her gas in order to get home at the end of the day. She took a shower, put on a t-shirt and underwear, and got into bed. In a letter to the district attorney's office, Avenatti's lawyers sent last fall, he claimed that she had been drinking and doing drugs on set, a claim she denied. He also said that she had recently started taking Accutane, an acne medication he said could cause emotional distress. She said she had only been taking the drug for 2 days and had no problem with it whatsoever. She was drained by the time Avenatti got home from drinks with a friend, but she told him she thought she needed to work more. She had been embarrassed having to ask for gas money, and she never wanted to feel that way again. He was sitting on the edge of the bed, she said, and he looked her right in the eye. "God damn it," she said. He yelled, mimicking how he stood up in the bedroom as we sat in her lawyer's office. "You MFing ungrateful bitch." She went to the guest bedroom. He followed. She said, "Get the F out," she recalled him saying. "You're just ungrateful and disrespectful." She started to text a friend to see if she could sleep there that night instead when he grabbed her phone. He put his hands on her shoulders, she said, and tried to force her out of the apartment. Her arms were slick from body oil after the shower, and he couldn't quite grip her. She saw that the window was open and started screaming for help, she says, when he got hold of one of her arms and dragged her first across the carpet and then across a hardwood floor. He opened the door and flung her into the hallway. "I was so shocked and shaking that I couldn't even stand up. I reached up to ring the doorbell for the apartment across the hallway, and he saw me. 'Are you effing insane?' he said. He pulled her back inside, and she warned him that if he did not give her phone back and let her go, she would count to three and start screaming. She started to panic when he didn't budge. That's when I really started to freak, and I asked him to please not come any closer. His demeanor immediately changed, she said. He said, 'Baby, come here. We're so much better than this.' I can't even describe that moment and what his eyes looked like a psychopath. All I could think was, he is going to hurt you." She made her way to the guest bedroom, put on pants, and made a break for the door. The elevator did not come fast enough, she said, so she walked toward the service elevators, where she knew there were cameras. He got in with her, pleading with her not to do this. She went down to the security desk in the lobby, where the attendants ultimately called the police. Avenatti was arrested around 2 p.m. the following day. He was released on $50,000 bail and spoke briefly to reporters. In a statement released by his law office that day, Avenatti said that the allegations against him were completely bogus, adding, "I have never been physically abusive in my life, nor was I last night. Any accusations to the contrary are fabricated and meant to do harm to my reputation. I look forward to being fully exonerated." The arrest was only one of Avenatti's Waterloos that fall. He launched another publicity war, this one against Brett Kavanaugh, in the midst of his confirmation hearings. But then his client, Julie Swetnick, backtracked on or contradicted portions of a sworn statement she'd given to Congress, alleging she witnessed the future Supreme Court nominee getting girls drunk so he and his friends could gang rape them at a party. In early October, Swetnick did an interview with NBC News, at which Avenatti was present and instructing his client, in which she contradicted her sworn statement. The FBI, in its Curt investigation into various allegations made about Kavanaugh's conduct, declined to interview Swetnick, and in her consequential final vote to confirm Kavanaugh, Maine Senator Susan Collins cited Swetnick and Avenatti's conduct as a reason why she doubted the validity of the claims against him and ultimately voted in his favor. It was a shift in the way the public viewed Avenatti, though he told me that Collins is the biggest fraud in the Senate and that neither he nor Swetnick changed a single vote. He said that he stands by her and her allegations. Then a federal judge dismissed Daniels' defamation case against Trump and ordered her to pay his legal fees. Avenatti told me that the judgment was what Daniels had been after all along, since it ruled that she was permitted to get out of the NDA. She described the case as a win after. A week later, a different judge in California ordered him to pay $4.85 million to a former law partner. The same day, his firm was evicted from its office in a Newport Beach building for allegedly failing to pay rent for the past 4 months. 3 days later, Senate Judiciary Chairman Chuck Grassley referred Avenatti and Swetnick to the Department of Justice for a criminal probe, alleging that they made materially false statements to Grassley's committee as it investigated the allegations, though nothing has since come of this referral. At the beginning of December, Avenatti officially took his hat out of the ring for his short-lived presidential bid. "I do not make this decision lightly. I make it out of respect for my family," he wrote in a statement on Twitter. "But for their concerns, I would run." In the United States of America, we don't convict people based on press conferences or indictments, Avenatti said to me in the glass tower on Santa Monica, without a hint of irony. This from a man who held a handful of press conferences outside Manhattan courthouses after Michael Cohen appeared for a status conference, despite the fact that Avenatti had been denied a request to officially intervene in the case against Cohen. "We usually require prosecutors to present evidence and facts, and depending on the strength of that evidence and those facts, then we either convict or acquit people." But Avenatti wouldn't go into details. All he would say was that he had not done anything illegal. He said there were things he regretted and would do differently, though he would not elaborate on what those things were. He did admit that there were all kinds of worries keeping him up at night. "I'm facing some very serious charges that could result in me spending a long time in a federal prison, and that's most certainly keeping me up. I'm facing the power of the federal government, which is enormous." In a follow-up interview in May, Avenatti told me that he had not taken on Trump, that had he not taken on Trump, he doesn't believe he would have been charged at all. "The government didn't begin to look at charging me criminally until I became one of the biggest threats, if not the biggest threat, to the President of the United States, and anyone who thinks differently is a fool," he said. He recognized, too, that he's in those crosshairs by his own design. Like Trump, he has a sense of his own drama. "The good news is that I'm incredibly fearless. The bad news is that I'm incredibly fearless," he said. "In racing, you have to have a certain level of fearlessness to be able to drive on the edge and succeed, but you can't have so much fearlessness that you are reckless." And approach things with reckless abandonment, because otherwise you end up crashing and potentially killing yourself. That's a very, very fine line. It's a razor's edge. Next photos, making the rounds. Michael Avenatti in New Hampshire last year while exploring a possible 2020 presidential run. At the Porsche Mobile One Super Cup, Barcelona, 2015. For Avenatti, it was always about the edge, getting as close to it as he'd let himself. That's why he raced cars and went into trial law, and probably why he allegedly thought he could get away with not paying taxes and maneuvering client money around, as prosecutors outlined. Before every closing argument I've ever given, right before I get into it, I've gone into the bathroom to look at myself in the mirror and taken myself back to a particular moment of growing up. The same moment. Because I've been nervous, or any time when I'm fearful or nervous, I take myself back to that moment. Avenatti says he lived a perfectly normal childhood in a middle-class family. His dad was an executive at Anheuser-Busch before he got laid off when Avenatti was in his late teens. He would not go into what that particular moment was when he was 12. He would only say that he grew up very, very fast, and I faced some challenges that molded me into who I am and instilled a certain toughness and a certain fearlessness that has stayed with me and in the fabric of who I am. That toughness, he said, was born out of necessity. Meniotti, in explaining why she feels some sadness for Avenatti, despite how he treated her, said that she thought his need to be fearless stemmed from an incident when he was around that age. Two people told me that the fear stemmed from concern that he would be taken away from his family. In April, Avenatti started telling me what he told himself in the mirror before every trial, but his voice broke. For a good 10 seconds, he couldn't manage a word. "I feel like this is Jerry Maguire, you know, when Cuba Gooding Jr. is on set and says, 'I told myself I wasn't going to cry.'" He laughed and drained a plastic cup of water. Meniotti would later tell me that Avenatti cried often, particularly when she was upset with him after he got hot-headed and she would want to sleep elsewhere or in front of her friends who were skeptical of him. "It was his way of manipulation," she told me. "Or maybe that was the realest Michael I had ever seen. He could be like a little puppy dog. Or maybe he's just not mentally okay." The other woman whom he was romantically involved with told me a similar story. "He could cry on command," she said. "He's a narcissist. And narcissists can always cry on command." Regardless, in his glass tower, the emotions overflowed. I take myself back to that moment when I was 12. I realize at that moment that what I'm fearful of and what I'm about to go do is nothing compared to that moment of fear. I drew on that before I decided to sue the President of the United States, and I've drawn on that repeatedly over the last 12 months. And I'm confident that, unfortunately, I'm going to have to draw on that over the next few months and beyond. One person who interviewed Avenatti a number of times over the last year explained that his working theory was that Avenatti was a guy who'd been on the run from a series of burning bridges for a while. There's the great expression, "Patriotism is the last refuge of the scoundrel." "I've always felt like running for president was his last option," he said. "He didn't have anywhere else to go. He was totally trapped. So he thought, maybe I can get around the fray." I asked him repeatedly to square why he would have made a decision to get into such a public life at the same time his private life was unraveling. If he wanted to get caught or punish himself or test the limits. Avenatti's explanation was that he didn't see this case rising to the level of attention that it had. Perhaps that is the only way someone with his baggage would have entered the arena in such a public way. I never imagined that this case would take on the magnitude that it did and would have thrust me into the spotlight and into the national spotlight like it did, he said. I have said many, many times over the last year, this is either going to end really, really well or really, really badly. I am most fearful of the fact that the rate of descent is greater than the rate of ascent. Some would argue at this point that I flew too close to the sun. As I sit here today, yes, absolutely, I know I did. No question, Icarus. There was a point, he said, when he was living out of a hotel in New York, where he would wake up every day and want to pinch himself because he couldn't believe what was happening. He was getting to sit across from Rachel Maddow and Anderson Cooper and talk to millions of people. He got to speak at the Wingding, a Democratic fundraiser in Iowa, to what he saw as a crowd blown away by his performance. The publicity he got for Daniel's case kept the campaign finance violations in the news, which did significant damage to Trump and people in his orbit. I couldn't believe how unbelievably great everything was, he got out before his voice started to catch again. Now there are days when I can't believe what a nightmare this is. I asked what it was like on those days. What did he do? Chin up, he said. Keep your feet moving. As soon as you put your head down or your feet stop moving, they tackle you. Now here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Risco. Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House on the Affordable Care Act, and ice cream for breakfast. What is your idea of perfect happiness? No contest, seeing my grandchildren enjoying each other. What is your greatest fear? The current occupant of the White House. Which living person do you most admire? My husband, Paul, who is an enabler of the exuberance of his wife and five kids. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? I'm not into self-deploring. What is the trait you most deplore in others? Discrimination for any reason. What is your greatest extravagance? Very dark chocolate ice cream for breakfast. What is your favorite journey? Home to San Francisco. On what occasion do you lie to make someone feel better about how they look? What do you dislike most about your appearance? Gray hair poking out. Which living person do you most despise? I don't despise anyone. Which words or phrases do you most overuse? A phrase that I think is overused is President Trump. What or who is the greatest love of your life? My husband and family, and the family I grew up in. When and where were you happiest? When I was raising my children. Which talent would you most like to have? To be able to sing with a good voice, so that I could sing to my husband. What is your current state of mind? Concerned and confident. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? That I would have focused more on languages. What do you consider your greatest achievement? Personally, family. Officially, the Affordable Care Act. What is your most treasured possession? Photos of children and grandchildren more and more. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? Despair. Where would you like to live? Where I do live in San Francisco, because it is heaven on earth. What is your favorite occupation? Doing crossword puzzles every day. What is your most marked characteristic? Being Italian Catholic and all that that entails, mother, pride, love. What do you most value in your friends? Fun. Who are your favorite writers? Bono, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, Shakespeare, Doris Kearns Goodwin. If you were to die and come back as a person or thing, what do you think it would be? I'm not planning on that. What is your motto? Don't agonize, organize. Thank you. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.